Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream event on the 29th of March 2022. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics here. Great to have you on board tonight. And yeah, I know it's budget night, and I'm sure there'll be some people listening to Mr. Frydenberg and all of the spin that he's throwing out there, but you're going to get more sense, I think, from listening to us tonight. So anyway, welcome, welcome. And just before I bring Damien in, let me just, as I always do, remind you that we don't provide financial or legal advice on the channel. We do moderate the chat. As at the 29th of March 2022, if you're watching this in replay, if you'd like to get a question tabled, use at Walk the World to make sure that I see it. I do encourage you to exchange comments in the chat, but I won't necessarily follow all of the threads. I've also enabled Super Chat, which means that you can get your question to the top of the list if you'd like, or if you'd like to make a contribution to help with the running costs of what we do here, that would be greatly appreciated. Anyway, without further ado, I'm going to bring Damien in. Damien, are you there?
Martin, how are you going?
I'm good. How are you going?
Very well, very well. So people can take a break tonight from yelling at the TV and yell at YouTube instead.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, I mean, I decided that I've been running these Tuesday evening gigs for every Tuesday for a long time, so I wasn't going to stop just because the budget was on tonight.
I was here first. Yeah,
exactly right. I claim position. Hey, look, there's a lot to talk about. And I guess one way into this is to look at what the market expectations about future interest rates are. This is actually the current 30-day interbank cash rate futures implied yield curve from the ASX, right? And they're basically saying, well, you know, rates are 0.1%, but over the next year or so, they could be more than 3%. So they keep putting it higher and higher and higher. And interestingly, of course, the US is also doing the same in terms of saying, yeah, we're going to see higher rates and maybe even 50 basis point rises. So suddenly the story is now one of interest rates going through the roof. So I guess the question is, are the markets right, or are they actually misreading what's actually going on? And will central banks drag their feet and hardly do anything? I mean, how do you make sense of what's going on here?
See, I'd add one more. The danger is, are the central banks going to do too much? That's probably the bigger danger. So it's worth highlighting that, you know, last time we spoke, Russia hadn't invaded Ukraine. So, you know, that we didn't have those extra that extra problems in terms of supply chains and commodity prices, sort of, you know, much higher, obviously. And last time we spoke, China wasn't largely in lockdown, you know, trying to keep this zero COVID policy going. And so both those are going to have an effect as well, especially in terms of commodity prices. So, so that's sort of like, a preamble. I think in terms of the interest rates, it's worth noting what they call the steepness of the yield curve. So in the US, what's happening is as these short-term rates are rising, the long-term rates are not rising as quickly or even, you know, drifting back a little bit. And so what we're seeing is what's called a flattening of the yield curve. So the interest rates at the two years. So as generally what happens is over time, interest rates get a little bit higher the further out. So if you want to lend the money to the government for 2 years, you get a little bit less. And if you're in for 3 years and further up till you get to 10 years. And what's called a flattening of the yield curve is when the 10-year bond basically gives you the same yield as what you get from a 2-year bond. And the reason why is because markets are basically pricing in to say that, okay, yeah, interest rates are on the way up, but actually that's probably going to cause a recession and cause problems, and so then they're going to fall. So yes, short term is interest rates up, but longer term, the net effect is weaker interest rates. The flip side, you going?
Yeah, I was going to say, and let me just put up, I've got the 10-year here. Let me just put the 10-year up so we can just have a quick look at that, right? So that's the 10-year. This is the US 10-year, right? So it's at 2.503, and the 3-year, missed that. The 3-year, okay, is 2.625, right? So the 5-year is higher than the 10-year at the moment, right? Which is completely nuts.
Yeah, well, that's what they call it, an inverted bond yield curve, and that usually signals in recession in some stage in the future. Mm. So that's what I guess the bond market in the US is pricing in. So they compare, you know, the 5-year to the 10-year, and then the 3-year to the 10-year. The 2-10 is probably the most common, and that's not quite at that's not
it's not quite there yet.
Not inverted yet.
No,
but,
no.
Yeah, that's sort of the I guess the bellwether one.
And let me just put out this is also a Bloomberg chart which I found, right, which basically says that
yes.
An inverted yield curve, if it happens, often portends a recession. And you can go back in history and see, you know, it doesn't happen always, but most times it does. So basically it's a pre-warning of troubled times ahead.
Yes, exactly. And so that's not happening in Australia. So Australia, we've actually got the bond yield curves is quite steep. And it's sort of almost, you'd call it almost headed in the opposite direction. So, which is interesting because Australia is usually a bit of a, you know, a supercharged play on world growth. Mm. So when world growth is going well, you invest in Australia. But so we've got the US basically saying, inflation's high, central banks gonna have to raise rates. Raising rates isn't actually going to do that much about inflation because it's mostly supply chain. And so therefore, you know, they're probably going to have to cause a recession to bring demand down to the level of supply is what I guess the US market is, in my view, implicitly telling us. Then you look at China. China's got this housing market implosion that's still – it's a slow-motion train wreck, but it's still a train wreck, and they're not looking like backtracking on it. They do look like they're genuinely serious about rebalancing their economy away from it. And they're locking down half their economy and trying to keep zero COVID. So, you know, Shanghai went into lockdown this week. Yeah, there's millions of people, you know, locked indoors. That's going to cause effects on the Chinese economy. So you've got US economy with some problems, the Chinese economy. Then you go to Europe, and Europe's facing record energy prices, and you know they've got they're much more tightly integrated with Russia. So when the US says, okay, we're gonna ban Russian oil, it's not really much of an issue because they never really took that much Russian oil as well. So, but for Europe, it is a big deal. And so they're facing, you know, these massive energy prices. That's basically a big drain on everyone's budget. You know, I'm sure everyone right now, you know, if you filled your tank up today, you know, you've just missed out on a little bit of a budget surprise from Frydenberg, I think, on in terms of cutting the fuel excise. But you also would have felt that, you know, the price you're paying now is, if it's not double what you're paying, you know, a year or two ago, it's not that far off, and that's a drain on everyone's bank accounts. And in Europe, you're facing that not only on your fuel price, but you're also facing it on your electricity bills and your gas bills as well. And so that's, we're looking at the three biggest economies, all with some relatively large headwinds factored in. And this is where the Australian bond yield curve gets a bit weird in terms of saying, well, why is Australia pricing in such huge growth if the rest of the world is looking like it's going the other direction? And so and you'd have to say it's a view on commodities and a view that commodity shortages are going to be around for a considerable period of time. And so you've got to get into Australia, and Australia is going to have this boom going while the rest of the world is busting. I find that harder to believe. That seems to be a tough line for the Australian economy to boom, commodity prices continue to boom, and US going to recession. Europe at least have a pretty decent slowdown, and China and the property market there, which is the world's biggest consumer of commodities, is going through this slow motion train wreck that's largely policy driven, but the policymakers seem to be content to let it go because they need to rebalance their economy. And so, that's where I'm sort of sitting. Is that a long-winded answer? But I guess the thing is, the Australian market seems nuts. The US market fits with my view, but I'm probably almost concerned about the number of people who have that same type of view that, look, the US is going to have to raise rates far enough that they cause a recession in order to bring demand back to the level of reduced level of supply. And we've seen all these extra supply problems hit over the last few months, whether it's, you know, Omicron, now China going to shutdowns, Russia and the fallout from various supply chains there, commodity prices and energy costs just skyrocketing. You know, all that sort of adds up to further extensions to those problems.
Yeah, okay. Well, there's a whole bunch of stuff to unpack there. Let me just, because I've got it, let me just put the Aussie 10-year up because it's quite interesting. You know, it's 2.912, right? But the 3 year, which is, you know, as we showed in the US was above, it's below here, so 2.494. So we have a very significant differential between that, which suggests, as you said, there's something different. And then your point is that the markets internationally are assuming that the commodity exposure that Australia has protects us. That seems to be the basic thesis. And presumably that means that they are expecting that China will continue to demand resources, particularly iron ore and other things, and maybe even LNG and those sorts of things will also be in high demand around the world. We're quite large producers of those. And that's why the Australian economy is regarded differently to the US economy.
Yes. And typically you'd expect that you know, when world growth is sort of 4%-ish, Australian economy booms. So it's got a super boom going on. But when it drops below 2%, then the Australian economy busts. And so this is basically saying we're going to be in this very special situation where the world economy is very, very weak, but because of all the supply shortages, the Australian economy is actually going to go really well, is what markets are effectively telling us at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other point there is that the rate of interest rate rises in the US are pretty much set, right? As you say, they're probably going to have to do enough to be able to sort of make things stall, which is actually deflationary potentially later. And I've always had this view that there's a deflationary risk because debt gets expensive, right? And once debt gets expensive, it's expensive from governments in terms of servicing the debt, and it's expensive to corporates who are actually running their business off debt. And interestingly, of course, here in Australia, we've got $1 trillion of debt sitting in government coffers at the moment. And, you know, the expectation now is the cost of debt in Australia is going to be higher than the government expected, right? And then we've got the question of the private sector about what happens when interest rates go up here too. So there is this debt overhang, which seems to me to be something which I'm not sure the markets have really sort of fully factored in yet.
No, well, I mean, you spoke there, the three-year rate, you know, talking about we're talking about a 3% increase over that period, 3% in interest rates. Yeah. So
over the next year and a half.
Yeah, I don't know how your models go with that, but I'm guessing that there's a few people out there who couldn't actually, you know, who might be on a 2% interest rate at the moment who probably couldn't handle a 5% interest rate.
Well, it is very interesting, and I just, you know, repeat back what I've said a few times. A 1% rise from, let's say, 1.99 to 3%, right, which best you could do, that's a 15% increase in the monthly repayment on a mortgage, right? A 2% rise from there, from 1.99 up to 4%, that's a 30% increase in monthly repayments on the mortgage, assuming the term of the loan is the same. There's a big quantums for households that are already in some degree of strife with rising costs, et cetera, et cetera. And okay, we're going to get a bit of a cut from the excise for a little bit, but, you know, that's really not going to touch the size.
Well, that just takes us back to where we were, you know, a month ago.
Correct.
You know, maybe not even that. Maybe it was only 3 weeks ago.
Yeah. So the point is that there's a lot of pressure on finances at the moment. Now, interestingly, the retail figures that came out today were actually quite strong. This is for February, right? So the growth through to year up to 9.1, although if you look at it in slightly more detail, it's quite interesting that it's not uniformly spread, insofar that we had New South Wales doing very well, but there were sort of downturns in Western Australia and the Northern Territory. Now, that's partly to do with the new lockdowns, I suspect. But it is interesting how, you know, the superficial sort of story is retail is looking quite good. But if you look carefully, and if you look at household confidence, that's now coming off again.
So this, and I think that's nominal prices as well, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Those charts.
Correct.
So you know, whatever inflation is, you need to knock that off. And I think there's certainly, you know, we're at that point, the point of quite a lot of structural frictional change at the moment. And so, you know, from what I, you know, my reading of it is that volumes are sort of average to weakish, but the overall, the actual spend is up quite strongly on the basis of price changes.
Yeah. So I guess one of the other sort of corollaries of all of this is that the US dollar versus Aussie dollar is doing very well, right? And I'll put this one up for a second. We're up at 74.98, which is extremely strong, right? Which basically would suggest that superficially, the rest of the world thinks we're a good bet.
That's reflected in the bond yield curve as well.
It is. So are they not seeing it the way we're seeing it, or I don't know. I can't make a lot of sense of those numbers.
No, and look, I'm struggling to as well. I think there's a certain element of what does Ukraine and Russia produce that they're no longer produce, right? Well, there's gas. Australia is the world's biggest gas, or top three at worst, and maybe number one depending upon what day we are in terms of gas exporters. So that's a tick. Without the recognition that actually that's mostly owned by international companies, and so the money comes into Australia and goes straight back out, and the tax take is very, very, very low. It's just a fraction of what other countries make from it. So there's not a huge benefit to Australia, although the money does, you know, notionally come in for us. Steel, and so Australia's one of the world's biggest iron ore producers, so that's sort of replacing steel there, and wheat. And so I think there's a superficial, that's what we're losing, and that's what Australia's got. So therefore, Australia must do well out of it. The question for this is, and I honestly don't know the answer to it, but it's an idea about these frictional issues. Is saying, there's definitely problems in terms of say US getting oil, sorry, not US, Russia getting oil out because all these people are deciding not to buy it. China isn't one of those countries, and China has tended to buy oil from even places like Iran and other places that have notionally got US sanctions against them. India is very similar as well. India's got quite close relationships with Russia, and in the past has been happy to buy that. So the two largest countries in the world by population and quite large oil importers, I think will eventually end up working out how to either get around the sanctions or just directly importing the oil, which is actually not subject to sanctions anyway. The oil, like, that was explicitly carved out of it. So I guess the question is that oil truly gone from the world economy, which a number of commentators say we've got to replace 4 million barrels a day of Russian oil? Or is there a short-term issue in terms of these refineries aren't set up to take the specific blends of crude, and there's issues about there was ships oil tankers that are owned by foreign companies haven't been going to Russia because they're not insured, and so because they're in an active war at the moment. And so if you own a ship and you do you want to send your ship worth tens of millions of dollars to Russia knowing that it's not insured, or are you happier just to say no, I'll send it somewhere else where I know that if something goes wrong, I'll actually get my money back on the ship. And so these problems need to get around. China needs to get around it. India needs to get around it. Whether they're hiring their own ships or Russia's hiring their own ships or whatever it is, or providing insurance or whatever, there's solutions to it. There's not short-term solutions, but in my view, over 6 or 12 months, there are solutions that will let that oil or the wheat get back out to the world economy. And so, is it truly gone? And I'm saying this as well. When I say this is my view, it's a weekly held view. I'm still looking for evidence either way, and nobody really has evidence and can forecast this stuff. But certainly in the past, China's been happy to take say Iranian crude, and so is India, and so it's hard to see what's going to be different this time around.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll just put the WTI up because it's quite interesting. It's now down to 105.62, right? So we had that very high peak at nearly 130, and it's come back. And basically, every time I hear somebody talking about it, they always say, well, there's two things. One is, there are peace talks to do with Ukraine. So, of course, everyone's now thinking it's not going to go away. And then the second is that China's got locked down, so therefore they're going to be less demand. I'm afraid I don't find either of those very convincing arguments.
No, that's right. And look, there will be some demand destruction. Actually, it's probably timely to put up some of those charts. I wrote something last week just on looking at electric vehicles. and saying, what's your payback? Because over the medium term, this is obviously not a short-term issue, but over the medium term, if you've got an electric vehicle, you're obviously not using petrol now. And so it might have been before that the types of economics you're talking about was your battery might have cost, say, six grand extra to buy the battery. Fuel might have cost you $4,000 a year, or electricity might have cost you $2,000 a year. So you're saving $2,000 by a year by doing it, but you've got to shell out $6,000 up front. So you've got like a 3-year payback on it. The thing is, when your oil price doubles, though, now you're paying, from $4,000 to $8,000 a year in petrol. Now you're saving $6,000 a year. You're actually getting your money back in 1 year. And so, so the question is at what level does it make a difference? And the US is actually, because it has quite low electricity costs, it actually makes a fair bit of difference in the US. I don't know if you've got that chart.
Is that the one with the US dollar per kilowatt? Is that the one you want?
Yeah, it's a payback period on
that
the
one?
No, that was the electricity one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
all right.
That one in a minute. There's a payback on
second.
Yeah. Payback on a little bit lower. That top one, yeah.
That one?
Yep.
Okay.
This one. So what we're showing here is if you had a battery that was the middle line's a 300-kilometer range on your battery, and at various oil prices, what's your payback in number of years? So if you're buying it today at, say, $100 oil, you're getting your money back within 4 years on it. If the oil price goes to $200, then it's going to take about 2 years to get your money back. And so just sort of giving you an idea of what the what's the sensitivity of that payback? And at what stage do people just start saying, I'm just going to buy an electric vehicle? Because on a commercial basis, so if you're driving like 50,000 kilometers a year because you're driving so much further, it's worth it right now. Today, your paybacks, at current oil prices, maybe a year, year and a half. So you're basically getting your money back very, very quickly on that type of deal. The interesting thing is, so that's the US. China is actually very similar in that China is it's quite likely that China will be switching to more and more electric vehicles because it's economically advantageous to them. Europe and Australia is not so much the case. It's actually because we've got higher electricity prices and higher electricity prices, and we don't drive as far as, say, the US. The economics for people in Australia or for in Europe switching to electric vehicles is not actually that likely. So you can see this is the Australian curve you've got up there, and it's shifted a long way to the right because our electricity is so much more expensive. And I do blame in many ways I blame the Australian government for not supporting electric vehicles more, which is why we've got such low penetration rates. But it's actually also our market structure that is driving that low penetration. Like, the economics just don't stack up the way they do in China or the way they do in the US. And so, I guess from a demand destruction point of view, at these levels, you will see demand destruction. There's just in the US and China sort of leading the charge. But the problem is it takes a long time to create cars and get the, create battery-powered cars that, in a sufficient volume, and also cars last a long, long time, and so you're only really changing a small proportion of the fleet. You will get some demand destruction from that, but that's a long way away from actually really making a solid difference to oil prices.
Yeah, and Ray actually asked this interesting question: what about battery replacement factored into the overall payback over the long term? I suppose it's the question: how long the batteries last
for? Most of them have an 8-year warranty on them, so it's an issue, but if you're getting your money back in 3 years on it, then, and you've got an 8-year warranty, so your battery's probably going to last 9 or 10 years, you'd think, at least, it's not really an issue this is getting into the weeds. It's predisposed on how small of a battery you're prepared to take. So the biggest selling EV in China at the moment has 120-kilometer range, so not very much at all. It's effectively a souped-up golf cart, that they're selling. The thing is, most people, that's actually enough for most people. But like most people drive 10,000 kilometers a year or 12,000 kilometers a year. You're only driving, that's, you know, 200 to 300 kilometers a week. So if you've got a battery that does 120K, you know, and you're charging your battery every second day, you're fine, except for obviously longer trips. But on, you know, over for most people, for their ordinary the cases, the issue is when you say, oh, no, 120K is not enough, even though, you know, even though it would be, I actually want a 500 kilometer battery. Now you've got a, you know, you've got a battery that's four times bigger and effectively four times more expensive. And so that other, 380 kilometers worth of range you've got is effectively wasted. It's just sitting there, not really being used from week to week. And so if you've got to pay for that, then if you've got to pay for that extra battery, then that's what really damages the economics of it. So, yeah, and that's why what those charts, if you look through those charts, it's up on the Nucleus site, it's very much showing that it's a mixture of how small of a battery will people actually tolerate. And that's, I don't know the answer to that. But it seems like they want at least 300 or 400 kilometers. And most gains in batteries are being put into longer ranges at the moment. So rather than saying, they're sort of going, okay, people are willing to wear $6,000 to $10,000 in batteries, and if batteries get 20% more efficient, then we'll make them go 20% further rather than reducing the price by 20%. So, yeah.
And there's a couple of people who say, well, again, I do a lot more than that just to commute to work. And, of course, people in regional areas will do much higher mileage or kilometerage than that, right?
Exactly. But if you're doing greater kilometers, then you'll save every kilometer you travel, you're saving. Because a kilometer on electricity is far cheaper than a kilometer on petrol. So for you, if you've got 50,000 doing 50,000, and I've got one of the charts there is sort of shows doing 50,000 in the US, all of a sudden you can take a much bigger battery. You can take a 500K battery and still make a decent payback on it. So, So it's very much dependent upon, really, it's the economics of, it's the same economics as solar power.
Very interesting.
You pay for it. Sorry, I'm not sure, I froze there for a sec. It's the same economics as solar power, where you pay for something up front and then you get a cost saving going forward. It's sort of very much dependent.
And particularly if you're charging it from your roof array, right?
Absolutely. If you're charging it from your roof array with electricity that you would have otherwise sold back to the grid, now you're miles, even in Australia, you're miles in front, because you're not getting much, but you're not getting rewarded for that power that you're putting back in. It's very low, very low return. And I've just seen a comment up there from Daryl on hydrogen. I look at hydrogen as well within that same report. The big issue with hydrogen is that you get about 70% losses. So you start with electricity, you start with, you know, whatever, one unit of electricity, you turn that into hydrogen, you then store that hydrogen, and then you go and burn that hydrogen and turn it back into effectively electricity that then gives you mechanical motion, and you've lost 70% of your original electricity. So that process is very energy destructive at the moment. There are some applications it still works for, and if you need to store hydrogen for longer periods, it definitely wins out. So if you need to store energy for, like, say 10 days, hydrogen's far better than batteries, because with a battery, you need to make a, you know, if you need to store a battery for just to get you sort of through the night, you might need like a let's say a battery to last you 6 hours, say. If you now want to store it for 10 days, you need a battery that's 40 times bigger. And so, whereas with hydrogen, that's not the case. You can get hydrogen, and hydrogen is much cheaper to store. So you don't need to, So hydrogen ends up for longer applications. For shorter applications, which actually is the vast majority of applications at the moment, batteries win out, you know, hand over fist. And it's because of that, you know, your round trip loss of a battery. I start with one unit of electricity, I put it into a battery, and then I get it back out again. You lose about 10%. Some of the newer ones, it's less than 5% you lose. Whereas, you know, that hydrogen, you're losing 70%. It's just too big of a hurdle to overcome.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just show you this. So this is the electric vehicle battery payback, assuming it's solar, right? So it's moved the curve down this way compared with previously, right? Makes the point that actually, if you can charge it from solar arrays, the economics moves significantly.
Yeah, and having said that, you know, it's not at the stage now where it's a no-brainer though. So if you're at a Tesla sort of 500 kilometer range, you've got an 8-year payback even on that, and that's roughly, you know, we spoke about the batteries lasting you 8 years. That's the warranty at least that lasting you 8 years. It's not an economic argument that people are going to rush out and say, I've got to do it, that 8-year payback. I sort of figure once you get down to a 1 or 2 year payback, well, sorry, a 1 year payback, definitely, but sorry, it's more like a 2 or 3 year payback is when consumers will actually start looking in seriously actually looking at moving across.
Absolutely. And Daryl makes the point that, you know, in Norway and Sweden, maybe people have two cars, one electric, one for just weekdays and the other for the weekend and for long trips. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, let's move the conversation forward a little bit, because one of the questions I had before the show started related to investment platforms.
Excellent. Actually, sorry, before we jump onto that, can I just really quickly touch on the other chart I wanted to show on there was the effect on electricity prices, and particularly in Europe is the big issue.
All right.
There was the table with the list of costs for electricity in that same report.
Okay.
Near the top. Now, what I'm looking at here is
that one?
The cost of generating. Yeah, that's the one.
Yep.
So we've spoken before about utility solar, which is basically, you know, these big fields of solar panels being the cheapest thing out there in terms of like producing electricity.
Mm.
And so in terms of US, and keep in mind, all these figures are sort of roughly, and it depends upon where you are and all these other things like that. But ballpark, costing about 3 cents a kilowatt, three US cents a kilowatt. I think it's even like getting close to 2.5 cents. So it's by far the cheapest. But obviously the problem is you can't, you know, the sun only shines half the time and you need to be able to store it. And so then you need this, I've put in two different measures, one with a partial battery and the other one with a full battery. So full battery basically lasting you through the night. And so, you know, at that, if you need a full battery, you're up to 9 cents, and a partial battery to sort of get through that evening hump, you're sort of bringing up to the sort of 6 or 7 cents. So the issue is more about the grey ones, which is this natural gas. Now, when natural gas, say in the US, is at $3 per MMBTU, or $3 to $5, it's better to have a natural gas-fired power plant than what it is to start putting batteries in. In Europe at the moment, we're talking more about $30. And you can look at those right at the bottom. You can see what price you're paying for electricity if you've got to shell out $30 or $20 or $30 to get your gas. And it is miles above the cost of utility solar plus full battery. Like it's at the stage where it is an absolute no-brainer to go out and buy a battery and, you know, get a solar panels to fill it up if gas prices are going to stay anywhere near what they are at the moment. The big issue is that you just can't get enough. You can't get the solar at the moment because we don't have the facilities to produce as much. And so, you know, there's going to be this real push over the next few years where politicians in Europe are very much going to drive this, is that it is at a stage now where it is a policy no-brainer to get off natural gas and get onto solar or wind plus batteries. And same with the coal. With the coal prices we're seeing, like you can see the fuel costs of coal at $300 a ton, which is sort of where it's touched. The fuel cost alone just to run this thing is higher than the cost of going out and getting a utility solar plus a full battery. So, notionally as well, you know, doing that in London, you're obviously going to do worse than if you're doing it in the south of France or in Italy, somewhere where you get a lot more solar resources. But, you know, that it's that idea that we're well and truly past the point now. Like the last few years, I keep talking about, oh, look, we're almost there. Maybe if solar plus battery comes down a little bit in cost over the next few years, we'll reach this point and it'll be worth it. But Putin's put on this Putin's carbon tax, I'm calling it, that's just made renewable energy, you know, the biggest no-brainer there is out there. And you're just going to see the problem now is capacity. We just can't produce enough batteries. We can't produce enough solar to get there. It's going to take years to ramp up those types of volumes to really make a dent in the demand side.
Okay, terrific. Well, we'll put a link to the article below, and people can go and look at all the charts and everything else, because I picked a few out from quite a long article. But it's really interesting, and it shows you those tipping points and how they actually are shaping, and how the economics are different in different locations.
Yeah, absolutely. And Australia's got the benefit as we've got some of the world's highest electricity prices. So, we suffered over the last 10 years, which means now we're actually sort of bumping, we're bumping pretty close to the top, and that solar is going to keep bringing us down. Whereas, and it's similar to Europe, but, whereas Europe's now going to suffer because of high energy prices from Putin and high gas prices, and the US and places like China are also suffering because their prices are so much lower than ours that they've got to go up to meet that curve. Anyway, sorry.
Platforms. No, that's good. That was sorry. I wanted to make sure we cover that off. Yeah, I had a couple of questions beforehand because people are sort of asking me a few questions about these investment platforms like Hub24 and NetWealth, and there's a bunch of others, right?
Absolutely.
And it would be really good to try and unpick the industry structure a little bit, because these are entities that have a technological capability. In some cases, they then provide that platform to wealth managers and investment advisors, and even end customers can access it. But they're clipping the ticket all the way through, effectively, aren't they? So that's how they're making their profits. And they are growing quite quickly, right? And one of the questions I had from Peter was, look, there are lots of different investment platforms. Their pricing structures do seem quite different. It's very hard to know which is the best or the worst or the good or the bad. So what would your list of features be in terms of selecting the ones that make more sense rather than less sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let me preface it by saying I've been through this process of picking a platform over the last sort of 4 or 5 years. I've been through twice, and I'm going through a third one, or adding a new platform at the moment to sort of broaden out the offering. So there's an issue that a lot of them have about dealing with lower value clients. So and when I say lower value, I'm talking $50,000 to $100,000. On some of the platforms, you're paying 2%. Like once you, because they have these initial fees. So for me, it's about saying, because I'm dealing with a broad array of customers, and I want to be able to turn to sit around to somebody who's got $50,000 and wants to invest it, and actually say the fees aren't abhorrently high. So some of them, and the reason why their fees are high like that is because they're actually not really interested in you. What they're really interested in is, $500,000 to $1 million clients plus, and they want it. And so for those people, once those base fees come in, they end up paying sort of maybe 0.2 to 0.3. Maybe even creeping up to, if you had $500,000 to $1 million, you might even be creeping somewhere between 0.2 and 0.5, say, from a lot of the platforms, of a percent. And then that's before you get your investment management. Then you've got to add your investment management on top of that. So that's really just an administration platform. So they do a good job. These platforms do let you invest in more cheaply than you might have been otherwise. Like you miss a lot of the trading fees and things like that. But it is worth noting as well that for a lot of them, the administration benefits actually accrue mostly to your planner rather than to you. Like it does help, but the real benefits and that's why all these people are selling to planners. They're not really selling to individuals. That individuals are sort of a side benefit. If they can provide a good service to a financial planner, that's what will then, the financial planner will bring their clients on, and that's what will drive it. Interesting as well, we've got a few big clients. Like we've got we were trying to get a client on for like 20 or 30 million, and they actually weren't interested. It was too big for them. They were worried that they've got these flat costs, and they're worried about their own risks and things like that. So really, most of these platforms have this sweet spot between, say, $500,000 and maybe $10 million of clients. That's really what they're trying to attract to their platforms. What else was I going to say about them? Knowing whether they can invest internationally or not is pretty key. Most of them are, the platforms are not, how can I put it? It's much cheaper than going to, say, a ComSec or someone directly, but they're still not as cheap on the international as you can get from somewhere like an Interactive Brokers or like a broker, that's an online broker that's going to deal with international shares as well. We've been looking at ones, and we've got a platform that we're starting to work with that sort of lets you get into those group trades, because that's where for us it's beneficial being able to say, okay, there might be a $10 cost to buy a stock, but if we're splitting that $10 between 1,000 investors, then there's almost nothing in terms of that fee, and then there's just some sort of small percentage. So it really brings down the trading costs. So that's what we've been looking at is ones with that and ones with low custodial fees. What else do you want?
Well, let me throw a question in, because Peter also asked about ownership of the funds. So when you put money into one of those platforms, who owns the funds?
That's right. Okay. So it's a complicated story. from a legal perspective, from an effective perspective, you have legal ownership through to the shares. So if in these cases, they almost always have a separate custodian. So, and what that means is that's the person who actually sits with the shares on their book. So let's say Praemium or Netwealth or Hub24, one of those ones went under. It actually doesn't affect the investments. What those companies are doing is effectively pulling the levers, telling the custodians what to buy or sell, and doing the tax reporting or the superannuation reporting that's required to sort of bring it back. So, in terms of that, there's not a risk in terms of that those guys aren't actually sitting with the money on their books. So then you look at the custodians. The custodians tend to be places like HSBC, JP Morgan, your large international banks. Now, while they have the shares, those shares are held in custody for you. JP Morgan or HSBC aren't allowed to say, we're running short on our wage bill this month. Let's go and take Martin's shares and sell them and use that to pay our employees. They're just literally not allowed to do it. It's not that's a jailable offense type thing. It's they're there to make sure your money is where it says it is. And then the Praemium and Netwealths are there to do the actual transactions and to do the accounting and make sure everything adds up. And then you get the investment manager like ourselves or plenty of other investment managers, and they're there to tell Praemium or tell Netwealth or Hub24, what do I buy and sell? So that's the bit. Have a look at the trading costs. That's a big one that I've seen. There's a couple of, especially some of the smaller ones, you can get some pretty hefty trading costs. Like some of them, certainly a few years ago, you'd see that they might be charging, for an international trade, they might be charging $70. Where on Praemium and your cost is, I think, $2.90 for the trade. So there's obviously a big difference if you're only buying $1,000 worth of shares and you've just shelled out, $70 on a trade. That's taken a lot, that's taken a lot of your potential profit away before you've even got started. I've got a quick comment there about saying low trading fees and funds can churn you. Look, absolutely, they can. It's certainly for the structure we're in, there's no incentive for me. Like, I don't make any money from trades. Praemium makes money from trades and the broker makes money from trades. From my perspective, when we're trading, we're trading because we genuinely think it's worth doing. There may be others that do benefit from the structure of the churning. So that could be an issue. What else is there that you need to look for? So you want to know who the custodian is. That's an important thing. If it's the same custodian as the company you're with, it is always a bit of a red flag. It's nice to have that diversity that they are at arm's length. I mean, that's where at the Royal Commission we had a few people sort of getting into trouble for that whole part about, I needed to pay a fine, and so then I paid it out of the members' funds, and because I also had the trustee, and so then the trustee just rubber stamped it and off they went. So that's when you get having some independence there is generally a good thing. What else can I say on?
Well, let me just put up Ray's comment. How do investors follow the money on the newer platforms when they try to hide the information or obfuscate it to make it hard to find?
Follow the money, I guess, in terms of following your own fees,
Well, I mean, presumably it's the fees on the fees, I suspect.
Well, that's a problem everywhere. That's a, I mean, they try and make it, they try and make companies bring it out to the forefront.
Yeah.
The one that usually gets hidden is an ICR or internal cost ratio. And what those ones are is where somebody goes, Martin, I've got this great fund for you. It only costs you 10 basis points, you know, jump in and you got it. And then, but what they've done is they've put all these other funds within it. They've put, you know, some Magellan funds at 1.5% or they've thrown in a bunch of exchange traded funds and all that type of stuff. So you're being told you're only paying 0.1, but you're paying 0.1 for the ability to then pay, 1% to all these other fund managers below it. And that's where the, generally speaking, ASIC tries to make sure people are disclosing that, and some people are very good at disclosing it, but there's a lot that make that very hard to actually work out that, I'm being put into a product that you don't actually, you can't see the fees on. So internal cost ratio or ICR is what you need to try and to get. Quite frequently, we will talk to clients, who are doing fee comparisons with us and others, and they'll be turning around and saying, oh, no, you guys are, whatever. 70 basis points or 80 basis points. I've got it at 50 basis points from, XYZ broker or XYZ. We're like, are you sure? Or a private bank. And we're like, let's go through and have a look. And when you look and you dig through, they might be paying 1.5% or 2%, but they think they're only paying 0.5% because that's the headline rate that keeps getting shoved to them is, here's your 0.5%. But that's sort of often that's just the advisor fee. And there's all these other hidden fees below it. So, that's always difficult. And the other one is structured products that you'll see not as much on these platforms, but certainly on if you're delving into markets is it used to be quite a common structure before is it say okay Martin, I'm going to sell you a product where if the stock market goes up you get the full benefit of the stock market, and if it goes down you'll always get your $100 back, and it's going to last for 10 years. You go, oh, that sounds interesting. It's a I've got upside but I've limited my downside. And effectively all they'd usually done was said, we're going to buy a zero coupon bond. So a bond that basically, so you give them $100, they put $70 into a bond that over 10 years is going to be turned back into $100. So that will cap your downside. And then they bought an option, a call option on the market. And so that gives you your upside. And that's a nice little structure and everything like that. But, and it gives you quite a nice risk return. But what they wouldn't tell you is they've ripped you off on the cost of the call option. So they'd say, oh, this has got no fees to it. There's no fees at all, Martin. We're doing this out of the kindness of the heart. And it was usually because they'd say, oh, well, we're selling you $30 worth of option. We're selling you with that $30, you've paid for $25 worth of options, but we've sold it to you for $30 and taken a 5% commission on that. And so when you get some weird and wonderful structures that start telling you that there's no fees attached, there almost always is fees attached. It's just that you can't see what they are, and often it's overcharging you for things within the fund.
Absolutely. Well, I always say the fees are the problem because, of course, the more you pay out fees, the more the returns have to more than cover those before you start making progress. And if you're paying them every year or every transaction, they can really create significant deterioration of the overall returns on the fund. And those fees are never fully or often not fully disclosed in some of those platforms. And so you actually don't know where you are.
Yeah. And look, I don't want to talk about premium in a bad light because we use them and they're all the same. But, when you look at the PDS, the list of fees is a mile long. And it's like there's a fee for this, there's a fee for this, there's a fee for this. We end up doing a calculation for people where we actually bring it up rather than saying, look, here's your 10 different classes of fees. We actually bring it all out and say, okay, how much are you investing? Here's where you're going to be in. Here's roughly what the fee will be from premium for that. It's just as bad with other ones as well. When you look at it, they'll give you a long list of the things there's zero fees for, but then there's quite a complicated list of trading costs will be this much and custody will be this much. And there's you know, there's an annual fee of something else, and there's a monthly something, and there's a cost recovery bit. There's all these other bits where it's honestly, for me, it's very difficult to work out what the hell's going on. Mm. Like, I've got a long spreadsheet to do comparisons between them, because it's like, oh, when one company, when Praemium says this, they mean the same as when Netwealth says that, and Hub 24 have a completely different fee, and so at lower levels it's much higher, but at higher levels it's lower, and yeah, it's a confusopoly.
I think it's deliberately obfuscated. And the other question which Ray asked was, are there exit fees?
Look, most of the so this is a complicated question again. most of the platforms, you pay for the trading. So the exit fee is effectively the cost of trading to get out. So on Praemium, if you're trading Aussie shares, it's like 90 cents or something like that. So it's a pretty low, you know, per line of stock you're doing. So it's pretty low in terms of the fees. Other ones you can get, you know, ones that charge $70. So that can be high. The other thing though is, if you're buying managed funds within your portfolio, they will also have a exit fee. And yeah, what the way they express their exit fee often is what they call a buy-sell spread. So the shares might be worth $3 in the fund, but what it is, they'll sell them to you. They'll let you sell it, say, $2.95, and so you're giving up 5 cents in order to get out of the fund, and that's their spread. Exchange traded funds do have a similar type of thing. So you buy them on the market. What tends to happen is that there's a little bit embedded in the exchange traded fund, because you buy the fund from a market maker who buys all the stocks and delivers it. So it's a little bit complicated, but that market maker has to make a bit of money. So you don't see the exit fee, and you don't see the entry fee into a lot of the exchange traded funds, but it is there embedded. On a fund like an S&P 500, which is, you know, like the most traded exchange traded fund in the world, that is a very, very, very small cost. It's it's so tight because so many people are arbitraging that. If you're investing in a quite a niche ETF, which might have, you know, its own blast of stocks, the spreads can be quite large, because they have to incentivize these market makers to go out and trade these things that just aren't that liquid or don't trade very often, and you don't see that. You don't get a statement that says, you know, Martin, you've just sold your shares, and you know what, you had to take a 3% loss on that because it was so illiquid that the market maker, you know, needed to have an extra buffer. Or that you were selling it in Australia, and this security is listed in whatever, you know, it's an emerging market fund that's listed in Brazil, and so the Brazilian market wasn't open when you sold it, and so the market maker had to you know, offset the risk, and so they discounted by 3% to make sure they could they'd be able to do the trade and not lose money on it. So yeah, there's a myriad of hidden costs that you get within those. Which I know is not going to make anyone feel good about it, but
it's important to keep underscoring that, right? Because they superficially can sound quite attractive, but you need to ask the right questions. And there was a follow up question from Alan, who said, "What's the difference between a Vanguard type operation and, you know, the like of Hub 24 or the other platforms? You know, are they the same? Are they different? I mean,
they're very different.
Yeah."
And I've also got that's a nice segue into a pitch I'm going to do for direct indexing. So a platform, effectively what happens is, you're going to a platform, and it's usually you're going through an advisor or you're going through someone like Nucleus, who's, you know, put you onto that platform in order to do the to do all that administration work. And they will buy direct shares for you. And it might be an active strategy, or it might be a passive strategy. So it might just be the same as buying an exchange traded fund. We have some products like that, where you can just go out and buy effectively an exchange traded fund. We don't make any active calls on it. You just get we charge 17 basis points or 11 basis points, depending upon which fund it is. So it's very cheap, and that's the fund you get, and you actually get to own the individual shares yourself. So that sits on the platform. What Vanguard do is, Vanguard go out and buy all the shares within an index. So if they buy the S&P 500, they buy 500 stocks in the right weights. And it's a little bit complicated how they buy and sell it, but effectively think of it as when you give them money, somebody goes out and buys shares and gives us, and you get units in the Vanguard fund, and Vanguard gets some more shares, and you know, to bring you into that. And then when you sell it, they go out to sell the shares and end up giving you back the money. So that's how Vanguard work. There's a third option coming through, which is we've just launched the first version of that in Australia. There's a couple of overseas, which is called direct indexing. And effectively what that is what we're doing on the SMA is where you have your index, but the idea is you can actually add or subtract stuff you want or don't want out of that, with the idea that, let's say you own banks. You already own some banks in your own name, and you're buying an Australian fund, and you're like, well, I'd like to buy an Australian fund, but actually I don't need any more banks, or I don't want any more banks. So knock those out of that fund. Now, you can't do that with an exchange traded fund. Once you're going to an exchange traded fund, you're getting everything. There's no, you know, in the words of Henry Ford, you can have any color you want as long as it's black. Whereas with a direct indexing, you can actually go in and make those changes yourself, and yeah, similar types of costs, but it gives you that flexibility to access those.
Yeah. So the bottom line, Damien, is there are lots of different flavors, right? And it's very important to parse them out and understand how they work, right? Because you can end up with quite different outcomes depending on precisely which route you decide to take.
Yeah. Now, yes, that's right. Now Vanguard is usually very, very good on costs. So, you know, I can't speak for, obviously, for every fund, and I haven't looked at every fund, but their big ones in particular are very, very good on costs, low costs. The issue is usually how much is it costing you to get into those. So if you do want to do if you're dripping payments in, you know, if I had somebody who said, oh look, you know, I'm going to invest 100 grand and then every few months I'll add another 5 or 10 grand to it, I'd be saying, yeah, that's fine. You know, the costs are going to be pretty small overall, depending upon who you're trading through. But you know, there's not a lot of costs within that. If you're investing $10,000 and you're adding, you know, $1,000 every few months, now those entry and exit costs, if you have to go through a ComSec or someone like that, might actually be a big issue. Maybe you're better off waiting, doing it once a year to sort of get those transaction costs down, or using a platform like ourselves or somebody else who will actually bundle up your trades and trade at, you know, 80 cents rather than trading it at $20 for a trade.
Absolutely. So shop around, folks, and ask the hard questions.
that's right.
Is my summary to that.
And have a look at the direct indexing, because I'd love to get feedback from people, because you know, my take is that, you know, the investment industry, in a way, you know, I spoke about that Henry Ford quote, is really, if you turn up to a managed fund or an ETF, you are getting that managed fund or ETF. You cannot change anything.
Yep.
And the flip side is, so it's sort of like saying, okay, you can have any car you want as long as it's black, or here's all the spare parts, you know, go to an online broker or go to a stockbroker and build the entire car yourself from scratch. And most people are like, well, I just want that car, but I want it in a different color. I want it in red, and I'd like some leather seats. And that's what I think the direct indexing is trying to do, is say, okay, start with an index that's already there, but you don't want any coal stocks in your portfolio, done. No coal stocks in your portfolio. Everything else is exactly the same. You want to knock the bank stocks out because you've got them, you know, you either don't like them or you've already got bank stocks and you don't want any more. Great, you knock those out of that portfolio, and now you've, you know, as a whole, you've got the investment you're looking for. Or you want to add some more tech stocks in, you know, go ahead and add some more tech stocks in.
Absolutely. So it's that intermediate, isn't it? It's neither building it from scratch, nor is it taking it just off the shelf. It's a little bit more flex.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Now, here's an interesting one. I don't know whether you have an opinion, but Madeline asked, what's your take on the new Aussie Bank crypto thingy? This is the ANZ. I don't know whether you saw the announcement the other day, but they actually did a one-off transaction using an Ethereum effectively stable coin. So it was on the Ethereum platform, it was a stable coin, a one-to-one to the Aussie dollar, to enable a digital transaction to go through. And they basically spruiked it to high heavens, saying this is the future, et cetera, right? As though it was something remarkable and something unique and et cetera, et cetera. So don't know whether you've got a perspective on it, but I made a show yesterday on it. So.
Oh, did you? Right. I haven't watched that one yet, Martin. I will apologize. But let me talk stable coins quickly.
Yeah, I do.
Because there's a great article, I think it was Bloomberg, maybe it was New York Times. Somebody did a great expose on some of the stable coins, a Tether in particular. And so I think it's the guy who wrote Inspector Gadget and one of the actors who was on Mighty Ducks is sort of like the big players in this. So they're obviously, you know, financial heavyweights. And effectively what they're doing, it looks like, it's very hard to tell because it's quite unclear, is they say to you everything's backed one-to-one with assets. Now, it looks like they've actually gone and bought a lot of emerging market debt, in particular Chinese developer debt. And we see Chinese developers fall over from day to day. And so there is a real question out there: do you really have a dollar?
Yep.
Or, you know, and it, or is your dollar, you notionally have a dollar of face value of some Chinese developer debt, but that thing's trading at 20 cents in the dollar. And so a lot of that stablecoin stuff, I am very suspicious of. Let's put it that way. If that was had a big blow up, I would be not surprised, you know, one bit that all of a sudden, you know, you find out that all these people who thought they had, you know, implicit backing and, you know, the hand on heart swearing of some guy with a company in Bermuda that this is legit, and, you know, every dollar you've got is backed by US dollars is will come unraveled. So
well, certainly Tether is under investigation in the US at the moment, particularly for that, which is to say, you claim it's a one-to-one match, but is it really?
Yes.
Now the ANZ one was a little bit different because basically it was a one-to-one match between effectively a digital Aussie dollar and a real Aussie dollar that allowed them to be then use the Ethereum network to be able to transfer, I think it was 30 million, very quickly, so that they are claiming that it was a very swift way of effectively doing an international transaction that would have otherwise taken a lot longer. Although the Ethereum network is quite slow, and of course they then converted it back, so it wasn't like it was being held in this this artificial state for a long period of time. But ANZ basically claimed that they are world leading, etc., etc., and claiming.
Okay.
That, yeah. So that was that one. Have a look.
I'll leave that one.
Well, if people want to know about, look at the show I made last night specifically on that, because it was quite interesting. But I'm afraid that I'm less convinced than many as to whether it really is revolutionary.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I always add on this one is, you know, these are private currencies, and so governments generally don't like private currencies, and if they get too big, there'll be their own downfall, in that if they're too big and people avoiding tax easily and all these other problems, is then it turns around to, I mean, you've already seen the Chinese government go, well, we'll create our own digital currency. And, that might sound great, but that digital currency is the Chinese yuan. It's backed by the Chinese yuan. They're using it so they can actually survey people and make sure they can see what they're transacting on, and make sure they're spending on, you know, goes into your social credit score. So, you know, sort of be careful what you wish for. This great bastion of freedom and anonymity is being used by China to take away all that freedom and anonymity. Yeah. And it makes a lot more sense for the RBA, for example, to have a digital currency that it can control, you know, the comings and goings of, rather than relying on, these free market ones that might end up, you know, could halve in price or quarter in price because, you know, something blows up, and then they could double and triple in price because, you know, everyone gets excited and Elon tweets something about it. So, absolutely. You know, I think the idea behind it is, if you want to trade cryptocurrencies because you think you can stay in front of the next person, and, you know, you're happy to, you know, treat it as a gambling exercise or a speculative investment, you know, go for it. But, I have lots of concerns about the people who say that, you know, this is going to be the, this is the greatest thing and everyone's going to do it. You know, name me the last time that somebody went out and bought a pizza with a Bitcoin, because it seems like nowadays it's morphed very much into a speculative investment asset rather than something you actually do use for transactions.
Well, it's interesting because if you look at Bitcoin, that some of the correlations we're now seeing, it's beginning to track the DXY more than it used to, for example.
Yeah.
And it's also got a lot of investment banks who have now created derivatives off the back of it, so they're actually taking positions to be able to actually hedge against it. So, you know, it's being pulled into the mainstream. It's being controlled by those same large investment banks. So in a way, it's no longer, you know, the non-controlled, deregulated, decentralized thing that it once was. It's being actually taken over by the big players.
Yeah, well, and I think one of the what I heard best description of the Bitcoin was what their what they are very good at is the story. Like that's Bitcoin's real strength is having a story that can morph. You know, it goes from being a great version of anonymous transactions and blah 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 to, you know, stick it to the man, and you don't have to rely on central banks to. It's an investment asset, or it's an uncorrelated asset. It's going to go up versus other things, or it's the new digital gold, or whatever it is. It's got it. You choose what story you want to hear, and you know, I can tell you a story about Bitcoin that fits that story, and that's their real strength. And that's, you can't, you know, I say it somewhat facetiously, but it's you know, you have to respect that in a way that, you know, that's if something you can't lay a blow on it because the story keeps changing. You know, when you bring up the issue of how much it costs to make a transaction, and people are like, well, no, it's not a transaction thing, it's an investment thing, and then they're talking to somebody else, and it's problems with investment, you know, going up and down, and oh no, it's not about that, it's about uncorrelated nature, and so yeah. I think there's
it's a chameleon.
It's hard to kill,
right? Exactly right. But going back to central bank digital currencies, you know, you make an excellent point, right? So the RBA now is looking not only at the commercial version of central bank digital currencies, which is where they started to look at it in terms of could they facilitate international transactions quicker and more effectively than the other payment platforms. They're now very much looking at retail digital currency, a central bank digital currency for retail, and of course Treasury is currently looking at that, as is the Bank of England, as is the Federal Reserve, etc., etc. Most Western countries are actually now actively exploring central bank digital currency. But I'm with you, you know, careful what you wish for, right? Because it's traceable, trackable, controllable. Effectively, they can even make them into you know, a currency that changes value over time, so that effectively, if you don't use a currency in a particular time frame, it can reduce in value, right? Negative interest rates, as well as track and trace and all the rest of it.
Yeah, I mean, the usefulness, though, like there was a, I think, I'm pretty sure New South Wales has been doing some, but certainly Victoria's been doing, you know, vouchers for regional travel and things like that. Like these are the perfect ones where you say, okay, well, here's a digital currency. Yep. Here you go, Martin, here's $200. You can only spend it outside of you know, the metro area, and you've got 6 months.
Yep.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's gone.
Absolutely.
And so, in terms of targeted stimulus and all that type of stuff, there's some great things you could do, but yeah, that's obviously So the whole idea is digital currency a good thing? Is like, yes, absolutely. And then the question is, is a private currency a good thing? And you say, well, maybe, maybe not. But the tendency in the past has been governments do not like private currencies. And if they get too big, then they squash them.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's probably a lot more to say. I might even make another show about this because it's developing all the time. But I always say to people, be careful. We would not want to sleepwalk into this future where effectively all your transactions are tracked and controlled and, you know, if they need to take interest rates in the negative territory, they can do it through a central bank digital currency. If they force everybody to use central bank digital currencies, so you suddenly find it's on your, you know, on your smartphone and that's your wallet and you've got no choice. And then the central bank gives you, you know, money that you've got to use. Oh, it's a nightmare. And then, as you say, link it back to social scores, which is what, of course, is happening in China. And basically, well, if you're not complying with the rules and regulations, suddenly you won't have access to your money. So it's a real big can of worms.
Yeah. I mean, we've certainly got cashless welfare cards pitched by several politicians. And so this would be the ultimate cashless welfare card saying, here's your money. Oh, you want to put that in the pokies there, Martin? Oh, bad luck, mate, you know. You want to buy alcohol with it? No. You're on welfare. You know, bread and milk. You know, that's your limit. Yeah,
absolutely. Now let me go on to bonds again. Cookie Boy asked this: bond markets to the moon or to the gloom? Discuss.
Yeah. Look, inflation's our big thing at the moment. And I want to, actually, it's well worth talking about that inflation part because so last time we were on. Let's go back a year. So a year ago, I came out and said, look, inflation's about to boom. We've got this huge run-up inflation. We've got we call it a inventory super cycle coming. But on the other side of that, there's quite a sharp fallback. Now, we've been wrong. So inflation stayed far higher. And at the time, there was effectively two different views. One was that inflation, one was that, you know, our view is, and we sort of quite early on the whole thing, yes, there's going to be this boom in inflation, but then it would fall back. And the other one was central banks have spent too much money. Interest rates are too, sorry, governments have spent too much money. Central banks have kept interest rates too long. Inflation is embedded in the system. It's coming. It's going to be everywhere. Now, we got that wrong on the transitory side. Does that mean that therefore the first argument is right? And I don't think it translates necessarily back that other way, because you can certainly point to saying we had these. So we had what we said, supply chain problems. The issue was those supply chain problems lasted longer than what was expected. Then we had another round of Omicron breakout, more shutdowns, more problems with supply chains. Then we had Russia and its pipeline to
Nord Stream 2,
yep. And energy prices spiking, and coal prices in China, and you know, problems in terms of transport costs there, sort of keeping things going for a bit. Then we ended up with Russia attacking the Ukraine, and sanctions and problems there. And now we've got shutdowns in China, you know, right throughout China because of their Omicron problems. So there's certainly a number of things that have really thrown this supply chain out of whack. And we just continue every time one of them seems to be fading, we get another one. So I think, you know, we still need to be aware to the fact, look, maybe it is secular inflation. Maybe I'm wrong. And that, you know, too much money's been spent and wages are now going to go up and people are going to get in. There's going to be this embedded idea that inflation's high and so therefore you need to ask for pay rises and that sort of spirals away. But I don't think that's – I don't think you can say, given the events we've seen, I think it still might be the case that, yes, transitory inflation, but it's been hit by five or six other quite large events that means it's going to last for another 6 months or possibly another year. But it is still possible that other side of that equation sort of comes down quite quickly. So a long way of saying I'm unconvinced still. I do think the problem is in the supply chain, and I do think given the words coming out of the Fed that they want to get on top of inflation, is that they're going to have to bring down demand, which is not particularly strong, but they're going to have to bring down that to meet a weak supply. And this weak supply is not going to recover quickly because of China and going into its lockdown and because of Russia's sanctions and just other structural issues. And so quite possibly they might have to drop the hammer quite hard. And even if they, you know, they'll talk about something coming to a nice soft landing, but you know, interest rates traditionally would take 18 months to flow through to the economy. That's why they usually stuff it up, is because they're still raising rates while the economy has actually already started to crater. They just don't work it out for another 6 or 12 months. And so, yeah, this idea of a nice soft landing, I think, is less likely. So I guess what it is that rates go higher and then they come lower. The problem is I would have told you exactly that same story 6 months ago. And, you know, can we have another series of events that then pushes rates even higher? And can we get, you know, real wage growth from, you know, a number of different factors and shortages and things like that? I don't think so, but you know, I have to acknowledge that's a possibility. So depends on whether you're calling which one you're calling gloom and which one you're calling doom. Is higher interest rates gloom, or is it doom, or is it low bond prices? But we haven't been on our lower risk accounts. We've got a market position in bonds and just sort of holding that because we're not quite ready for this other side. I'll be happier to miss sort of the absolute peak in bond yields and sort of pick it up on the way down. But I do think, you know, as per our discussion earlier, I do think in terms of mispricing, the Australian market certainly seems mispriced relative to other international markets. It seems like bond yields are way too high. And given the amount of debt in Australia, I just can't see how we could handle 3% higher interest rates without a massive recession.
No, and of course, the point about the interest rate differential is if we keep our rates low relative to what the Fed is doing, that's going to have an impact on the exchange rate. Now, I said earlier on, the exchange rate is actually quite high at the moment, so there is some capacity to drop the exchange rate and take some of that out of it. But there will be a point where you know, those differentials will actually have an impact on the cost of funds. So when the banks, for example, are now going and, you know, refunding their books, they're going to have to fund at a higher interest rate. That is going to put pressure on bank rates, even if the RBA doesn't do anything centrally. And we're already seeing with fixed mortgage rates at the moment. And of course, all the banks are encouraging people to take variable rates because it allows them then to put the rates up.
Yes. Yes, exactly. I had a thought on that one as well, which was that I lost it. Okay, that's all right. It'll come back to me.
That's fine. And Samuel asked, do we get a housing crash on the back of rising interest rates? Then that's the point, right? So how much pain can households take? How high can interest rates go? As we said earlier on, more than a couple of percent, it's going to create significant issues.
Yeah.
The Reserve Bank knows, of course, that we're highly leveraged. The banks are highly leveraged to the property market, so they're going to be quite sensitive to rates.
Yes. Yeah. So this is the, I guess, the saving grace in Australia is that the Reserve Bank is quite dovish still. They're still talking about lower rates, and we don't really have an inflation problem yet in Australia. Not to say that, you know, given all the events, that it won't come, but so because what's interesting is when you look at the bond yield curves, it's effectively the US saying, okay, bond yields are going to go up, but then the Fed's going to do too much, and the whole thing's going to come crashing down, and you know they're going to need to be raising rates.
Yep.
And you've got the US Fed out there saying we're going to crush inflation, we're going to do what it takes. You know, we're out there to raise rates and crush inflation. On the other hand, in Australia, you've got this thing going, hey, it's going to be a boom. You know, we're going forever. And the RBA is going, I don't know, it is going to be a boom. I'm too scared to raise rates. And so it's actually, it's almost as if, given the bond yield curves, you'd almost expect the two central banks to be reversed. That, you know, the Australian want to be out there saying, no, we're going to crush inflation. Look at that growth curve and look how high the bond yields are. Whereas they're the ones going, I really don't know we can handle that higher interest rates. And so, yeah.
And then if you think about the budget tonight, they're throwing more money into the economy now, right? Which has potentially, one, an inflationary impact, maybe quite significant, and two, if the economy is so strong, why are you throwing all this money into the economy?
To get elected.
That's
too simple. Or is it to create a problem for the government that does get elected?
Both of the above, yes. Maybe there is a time when it's good to be the opposition rather than the government in power, right?
Yeah, that's right. Well, and so, you know, I guess in their way, it's like let's throw some more fuel on the fire and hopefully we do get inflation going and maybe we'll get voted back in and so that's a win. Or maybe we'll create problems for Labor if Labor ends up being the one in charge. So, you know, I guess it's a throw of the dice that they're hoping they can win on either direction.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe not win, but get some satisfaction.
Exactly. Now, we're in the last 10 minutes of the show, but I had a couple of people asking about gold, and I thought I might just put up the gold chart, right? So we're at 1915 at the moment. So gold has, you know, come up. It was knocking around the 1850s, 60s for a bit of time, and now it's went up over 2000, it's come back again. And basically, the question is, I thought gold was meant to be a hedge against inflation, and why is the price not higher?
Any thoughts? And it's also a hedge against, you know, uncertainty and geopolitical risk as well. And so, you know, we obviously had that spike higher, but, you know, Russia's been threatening to use nuclear weapons and it does look like, you know, we're settled in for quite a long haul, and you wouldn't think sanctions are going to change anytime soon. I think there's some reasonable questions to ask. Now, the issue with gold, obviously, we've spoken about in the past, is it's a greater fool investment in terms of what you're really trying to do is you're trying to guess what other investors are going to do. And because other investors are actually the biggest users of gold. So whereas in other things like even platinum or silver, there's a lot of industrial uses. And so, that can sort of drive demand. Whereas in gold, it's either central banks buying or it's investors. And so what you're really taking a bet on is when event X happens, other investors will think that's bullish and therefore they will buy gold. So I will buy gold first or vice versa. So, I guess a couple of questions is, one is, well, is Bitcoin getting in on the game? Are you finding that every time, an older person dies and you've lost one gold bug you haven't got a new one coming in the other end because they're a Bitcoin adherent. So maybe that's the case. Maybe there's a case of central bank buying. Is there are you finding that some of the countries that, say, Russia or others that might have looked upon gold as being a this reserve that they wanted to own are looking at US sanctions and deciding, well, maybe it's not as useful as what I thought it was. And so lowering the amount they're buying. I guess I don't have any nuggets of real wisdom or conviction calls on it.
Nuggets of gold.
Other than to say, yeah, that's right. Other than to say that, look, it does tend to be an asset that's not as correlated to other ones. You will benefit if the Aussie dollar falls. So that's the other thing is pricing in. The strong Aussie dollar has affected that gold price. But over and above, what you're really doing is betting against other investors. Is you're saying, if I'm buying gold, it's because I think there's other investors who are going to want to buy it or other central banks, and I'm just getting in before them. And so, some of that narrative breaking down is concerning for the gold.
And the point again, I always have to come back to the underlying relative to all the derivatives, it's about a 50-to-1 relationship, right? So there are lots of people taking positions around gold and futures and options and those sorts of things that are effectively making money on the movements and even small movements. And they're also actually want to keep the price within certain bands, because if they move beyond those bands, they're going to actually take a big hit. Mm-hmm. So there are things going on in the gold market which are not necessarily obvious, which suggest to me that it is more controlled. It's not as a free market as many believe. And by the way, I have this theory that that's probably true also in the non-London markets too. So there are a bunch of reasons why the price is not performing the way that people might have expected it in the past. And I don't think that's going to change anytime soon because of this one-to-many relationship between the underlying and all the derivatives that sit over the top.
Actually, that reminds me as well. I think I meant to talk about this on last show. When you are talking derivatives as well, it's worth noting that there's... the people who make the markets for derivatives are effectively like bookies in terms of the way they're not trying to make money. Then when you go out and say, "Yeah, I want to buy, I want to buy gold, or I want to go short gold, or whatever it is," the people who are doing that effectively going, "Okay, well, Martin wants to do one side of it. I need to find somebody to take the other side of it. I need to get him better odds or whatever it is, and I'm just going to take a margin in the middle." So, the issue with them as well is they do what's called delta hedging. So what that means is, as the price goes up, they either need to buy more or sell more or whatever the case is, so that they don't lose any money. So price movements mean that they get out, they're actually out there trading. Now, it gets quite complicated, but the simple version is that there's some different factors and different structures in the market that mean the way they have to buy or sell changes over time. So at points in time, what happens is, they're quite good at dampening volatility. So basically that means as market's going up, they need to sell to so they don't close out their positions. Yep. And that actually helps to stop the market from going up as much. And then the same on the downside, when markets start going down, they actually need to buy. And so that sort of helps to dampen out volatility. Right now, it's the opposite. So they tend to be buying as markets are going up, they're buying. So they're adding more fuel to the fire and markets are going higher. As markets are selling, they have to sell in order to keep their positions hedged. And so what that means is that's helping us in terms of why we keep seeing a 2% up day and a 2% down day and a 3% up day and a 1.5% down and all these bouncing around is at least in part because part of the structure of the derivatives market is at the moment is that it is increasing the volatility that's out there.
Spot on. And going back to what I said about Bitcoin, right? A lot of those same players are now doing precisely the same things with Bitcoin. They've got these various other derivatives contracts and what have you. So it's the same old, same old.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it really is for them, if they can offer a market where they're finding one investor who wants to go long and one investor who wants to go short, and they both want to do it with leverage, and they can just take a slice in the middle and charge a 1% fee, done. Yep. They're well, they don't care. They're hedged on both sides. Whoever wins, it's just losing from another investor. Yep. They're taking money every single time.
Clipping the tickets once again, right? And there's a lot of that across the financial system. a lot of hangers on.
Yeah, and that's this argument with you get this argument about active versus passive, and that's the one that you keep getting out. Some people go, "Oh, passive will outperform because they've got lower fees," and that's there's certainly lots of different things that can show whether that's true or not. I think my take is that active tends to outperform, but most active managers tend then to take most of that outperformance back in fees. So if you're paying somebody 1.5%, 2%, or 2.20%, chances are they're getting some sort of outperformance, but then they're taking all that back and probably more in fees, which is why what you were talking about fees, fees are important, making sure you're not paying too much in fees on products so that you're not losing all that upside. So you get passive one, which actually by definition is going to perform under the market because there's some sort of fee within the passive. You get active ones, which make money, generally make more money than the market, but then take most of it back in fees. And then they're the ones who's winning. And then the person who's losing is actually your retail investor. And they tend to lose. I think the numbers are about 2%. They underperform by about 2%. Mm. And the reason generally is actually psychological, is that when markets are booming, they're like, "Oh, got to get in before it's all over." And then when markets bust, they're like, "Oh my God, I'm never investing again." And so they tend to do exactly the opposite of what they buy high and sell low. And so, psychologically, that's why either way you want to be using an advisor so that you've got somebody else making those decisions for you, or you want to be setting yourself those plans to go, "Okay, I'm investing every 3 or 4 months. I'm not even going to worry about markets up or down. I'm just going to keep that money going in either you've got to, or you've got the temperament to do it yourself. But keep in mind that the vast majority of people don't. They get too excited when markets are going up. They get too morose when markets are going down.
Yeah, and of course we know that there are a lot of relatively new investors who are into the markets. With the Robin Hoods and the other, cheap trading, and there's some of the professional investors sitting on the side. And the people who are actually losing money at the moment, a lot of those relatively new retail investors.
Yeah, that's right. And so, I guess we started Nucleus with the idea that the word is actually this, got this core investment that sort of sits in there, and that's your safe money in blue chip stocks, cash, bonds, large instruments that tend to be, one, quite liquid, but also tend to be less volatile. And then around that, you can put small cap equities, you can put hedge funds, you can put distressed debt or whatever other things you want to do around that, with this idea that you've got this sort of core holding. Now, for some people, that core holding is 90 or 100% of all their investments, and they're just like, "Yeah, that's all I need." For other people, it's it's 20% or 30%, and they're doing all these fancy things around it. So I guess what I'd come back to, though, for newer investors is saying, look, err on the side of caution. It doesn't have to be our fund. Love it if it was, but, get some funds that have got that sort of lower risk sort of part to have your money in there. And then as you get better and more knowledgeable, then you can start adding more of those satellites and taking advantage. And the other one is hubris as well, is that, every time you get something right, just double check to yourself, why did I get that right? And did I just get lucky? Because, there's this smart versus lucky index, and people sort of go, "Well, if I was right, I must have been both smart and lucky." They forget whether they're lucky. They always go, "If I'm right, I must have been smart." They sort of don't account for the fact that they might have just been lucky. They might have actually had completely the wrong reason, but Russia just attacked Ukraine, and all of a sudden I bought oil because I thought something was going to happen, and that thing didn't happen. Actually, the opposite happened, but Russia just attacked Ukraine, and so I won out. And so you go, "Yeah, I'm really smart, aren't I?" But we're saying, no, I just got lucky on that case. Yeah. Versus the ones where it goes down, people are always willing to admit, "Oh, I was unlucky. I was smart, but I was unlucky." But yeah, so they're just trying to make that that hubris part is always a, for everyone, for every investor, myself included, it's always the hardest part to go, "Yes, I got something right. Now let's not get carried away."
Right. And sometimes you can actually reinvent history afterwards, right? There was always an excuse, always a reason.
Sometimes, every time. Yeah, that's right. There's we're all storytellers, yeah. You know, at heart. I guess it's that part about saying, yeah, trying to be honest and genuinely evaluate and say, and inflation is a great example right now. You're saying, okay, we need to be. Is it that the only reason inflation is high is because we've had another version of Omicron with lockdowns? We've had China going to lockdowns. We've had Russia attack Ukraine. We've had energy prices sky high. Is that the only reason we're seeing inflation high, or is it the fact that that's embedded? And you need to accept that both of them might be true, but just keep evaluating that. Don't just sort of automatically go, if you'd chosen that, I think, if you said, central banks have spent too much money and interest rates are too low, therefore there must be inflation. Inflation appears because of supply chain issues, and you go, I was right. And you're like, well, no, you didn't even mention supply chain issues. And so, yeah, so it's that coming back to that reevaluate. Yes, I got it right. Now, did I get it right for the right reasons, or do I need to reevaluate what, my core thesis?
Yeah, no, very good advice. And as with all these things, don't get carried away and just think twice. And Now, there was one quick comment which somebody put up a little while ago. Mediocre put it up. Our rating agency is raising concerns about Aussie government debt budgets. No, we're still AAA. We're one of the small number of AAAs at the moment. And in fact, most of the rating agencies seem quite happy with our level of debt.
Yeah, we're much lower than elsewhere. Yeah. That's one thing. In a way, it is a little bit of a relative game. So if you're going to be AAA, you've got AAA debt, then the ratings agency tend to want to give at least a couple of countries AAA debt. So it's not like they can sort of turn around and go, okay, nobody's rated AAA anymore and everyone's rated B. They do play that sort of relative game. And on a relative sense, Australia has got lower debt. Australian government has got lower debt than most others. Australian consumers don't. Australian consumers are right at the top. But the Australian government has quite a low level of debt. Don't rely on ratings agencies to be your by the time they've changed, it's too late. Yeah.
Absolutely. Just remember what they were saying just before the global financial crisis, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. They're excellent at closing the door just after that horse is out and down the street. So, completely ignore them, but I certainly wouldn't use their ratings as a guide for investment because you'd be too late.
Not least, of course, because they also often get paid to make a rating.
Oh, almost always get paid. Yeah, that's part of the issue, and it's a similar problem with getting rated by. I've faced that problem getting rated by companies like your Morningstars or people like Zenith and those guys, where you basically have to turn up to those guys and say, here's 20, 30, 40 grand, please come and rate me as a company. And for those guys, they're like, well, okay, I've just accepted whatever this money is from Damien. Yes, I'm going to be independent, but if I tell him that he's not rated, then is he going to come back and give me that same money again next year? And so... it's a constant question that goes through, and the structure is not the best structure for investors, obviously. And that was the problem as you said, in the financial crisis, was all these CDOs was that they'd turn up to S&P and go, here's this pile of trash, can you rate a AAA? And if they went, nah, they'd go, oh, no worries, we're off to Moody's. And then they'd say, oh, really? Oh, okay. And by the way, I've got another 20 of these deals, following just behind it. And they'd go, how much money am I going to make by rating all these deals? Okay. And so click the ticket. And so.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're out of time, unfortunately. I would love to go on chatting a bit longer because there's lots of questions that we haven't got to. But anyway, I want to say, Damien, thank you very much for your spending time with us again tonight and getting your insights. Really appreciate it. Some really important messages there, I think, for, how to think about investments in the current environment. And it's still... be cautious is I think my summary, right? There's a lot of uncertainty out there, but also just kick the tires.
I wish I could tell you buy with your ears pinned back, but I don't think it's time yet.
Very, very good. So thank you very much. Appreciate that. And we'll put links to the What the World Fund and Nucleus Wealth below. There's a lot of really good material on the Nucleus Wealth site and, of course, the What the World link there. Thank you very much. We'll do it all again next month, by which time, who knows where the markets will be.
Excellent. Can't wait.
There. See ya. I'm going to take you offline and I'll close the show. Thanks. See ya. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
So there you go, folks. Hope that was an interesting conversation. Sorry, I didn't get all the questions, but I think we've got quite a few. And just to say that next week, I will be going through the household stress update. I thought it was appropriate to actually do it as a live show because there's so many changes going on and I'll update all the data. So join me next week for a specific show looking at the latest data, and I'll have the postcode engine and all sorts of other things online there for another conversation. Anyway, I want to say thank you very much. I won't go back to the doggy cam because Luna's now walked off as well. She's gone. Oh, dear. So she's obviously gone around the corner to sit on the couch as well. So I'll have to set up the camera differently next time. Anyway, thank you very much for spending some time with us this evening. I hope you found that useful. And I look forward to seeing you live next week or catch up our other shows during the week. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics signing off. See you next time.